NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say we've got three sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, Piston Power, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance.
Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. I'm incognito. That's why you get to see a picture of me instead of the alive me. But it's always good to be with you guys. I'm traveling up north where I guess it's the land of the midnight sun because it was 1 o'clock in the morning and it was still pretty sunny up here. So where I am. Anyway, we are coming to you to talk to the fact that Air India is in the news once again. It is scheduled to be prominent as far as a discussion because the preliminary report is scheduled to be released on Friday. The fact is that we've always heard, I think, some dates in other accidents where there were promises made about reports being released and things like that, only for us to have waited and then let the time pass and people are asking. So we're hoping that again, Friday is the day that we're going to get at least some information.
Friday is about 30 days after the date of the accident, which is which was June 12th. And the release date of the preliminary is supposed to be July 11th.
And that Todd was a perfect point that I was going to bring up. And the fact is that we're 30 days into this investigation. And there has not been one word, no official statements of the progress of the investigation, other than some very cryptic messages from the Indian government that the quote boxes, you know, have been read out. Okay, great. Where's the information that this preliminary report is going to be released? It's like, great. You know, we'd love to see the preliminary report, but can't you give us something until that report comes out? As we've talked off the air between the three of us, the biggest questions that I have, and I know that you all have, is we're 30 days in with no information, nothing when it comes to any flight safety related information that addresses either the aircraft or the engines, given the fact that everybody has made a storyline about the aircraft or the engines or a combination thereof. I am concerned that, you know, John, we would typically have information coming out. If there was a safety of flight issue with the airplane, it should have been known and published and acted upon, you know, right after the accident, not 30 days after the accident. If there was a problem with the engines, I would have expected there to be some action taken right after the accident, not 30 days after the accident. And I know you share that as a former NTSB board member, because the fact is that we have a team over there that really hasn't been privy to any data that we're aware of. I'm sure they know something, but the FAA is responsible for continued airworthiness of the airplane. And how is it that they're very silent? There's no action being taken either by FAA, NTSB, or Boeing, or GE. So what does that mean to you? Because I know what it means to me.
Well, first off, no action on their part involving the airplane, the operation of the airplane, or the manpower in the airplane. It's very, very concerning. They don't say, yes, this was a good crew. And they've been absolutely quiet. And we've been talking about it for the last 10 or 14 days on these podcasts. The fact that they're not talking about the first officer, you know, that alone raises issues with the first officer. There's something going on. 1,100 hours claimed time for the airplane. In the U.S., you couldn't get in the cockpit without 1,500, but that's the U.S. And not following ICAO procedures. Right? The rumors are pretty strong that the investigative teams from the British and the U.S. Did no meaningful work over there. They're supposed to be part of the investigation, you know, and they were very surprised. There were statements issued by some people that our team over there, the NTSB team, was very surprised to find out that the Indian government bulldozed all the material from that airplane into a great big pile, including the bodies. It's still mixed into all the debris. Right? So one question that keeps popping up to me, why are they not following the ICAO procedures? They signed procedures. And what's ironic about this is the Indian government, and like some of the others that have had accidents, they rely upon ICAO. They love the ICAO provisions that allow them to get their tickets prayed for through the processing. ICAO rules about processing money for tickets when you fly half flight on somebody else and then pick up Air India, right? So there's a process where they get their money. They like that from ICAO because it has to be given to them without delay. There's all sorts of rules in it. So most people may not realize that ICAO, the accident investigation portion, is Annex 13. There's 12 annexes before that that deal with all kinds of other operational issues in aviation. India's choosing not to use Annex 13 to run mm-hmm. their accident investigation, but yet they love the other ones. So, you know, it's just, you know what? I smell a rat.
Well, on the subject of the ICAO suggestions and requirements in Annex 13, my understanding of it is that certain parties are pretty much automatically part of the investigation. For example, the airline. And I have not seen anything in any announcement from the Indian government or any press release that says that Air India is a part of the investigation. Am I wrong on that one?
No, I actually saw something that said they weren't party to the investigation. Early on, it was reported that they were not party to the investigation.
And when you look at it, the NTSB FAA team and the British AAIB team, all they are is technical advisors. They're not considered parties, but they are technical advisors. Given the fact that we're state of manufacture and we are the state of certification, with the FAA being responsible for continued airworthiness, that's the expertise we bring to the investigation, other than the resources. It is also my understanding that the press made a big deal about the fact and the Indian government made a deal about the fact that these are combined boxes. And we did a show previously where we referred to the cockpit voice recorder and the flight data recorder as separate boxes. That's because that is what the general public knows. We do now have these combined cockpit voice recorder, flight data recorder boxes, and we didn't discriminate between the two when we discussed it before. The fact is, one of those combined boxes, from my understanding from a very reliable source, did come back to the United States, went to the NTSB. The Indian government asked the NTSB to fix a damaged box. Didn't read it out, didn't have access to the data, but fixed the box, and then it went back to India. Again, I've got a reliable source. I trust him, you know, 90%. You can never say never. But regardless, The question is, why, if the data has been accessed, why hasn't it been shared with the technical advisory teams? Why isn't there any input? And John, you know, because I've been through this situation with our former organization, where when I was working foreign accidents and I called back to brief the board, next thing you know, I'm reading about it in the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal or whatever, because one, nobody can keep a secret. The NTSB can't keep a secret. The FAA can't keep a secret. You know, there's always going to be leaked information. Yet this has been tighter than a drum, no information, which suggests that either people have very cryptic information that isn't worth leaking, or there is something else going on from a criminal intent type perspective, and people have been told, you don't talk about it, and we're not giving it to you.
The people on scene, I've talked to several that were there, and they said that they were very forcibly told not to talk about it. I don't have a problem with that.
No, I don't either, but what I do have a concern with is what's going – I mean, if there was a problem with the airplane, I don't care if they were told forcibly not to talk about it. We, as the United States, have a responsibility because it's our airplane. And yet there's no action, which leads me to believe that if there was a real concern, the FAA would have taken action, Boeing would have taken action, GE would have taken action, and the NTSB would have been pushing that action.
All right, so let's pause there for 1 second, and let me throw something out to you. What if early on in this investigation, because we know this airplane had a quick access recorder, it has two double units. All right, so just make it clear to everybody listening that doesn't know, the voice recorder and the flight data recorder are combined into one electronic box. There is one electronic box in the front of the airplane and a duplicate in the back of the airplane. And it gets into the way the rules are written for recorders, and that's too deep for this discussion. But in any event, there were two of them on the airplane, plus access through a quick access recorder, because most countries have rules about downloading information off the flight data recorder. There is a separate device that downloads data from the aircraft data buses, and it's there for access by the company and others to look at the performance and look at problems that we had. And on a recent show with Todd and I believe just the other day, I mentioned that on the approach to San Francisco, because the airport in San Francisco has two parallel runways that are too close together by today's standards. And because of quick access recorders, we were able to determine that air traffic control, in order to keep the flow up, because there's a lot of airplanes trying to get in and out of San Francisco, in order to keep the flow up, they were asking pilots to perform procedures that were not appropriate. And because of those recorders, we were able to identify that and get air traffic control to not push pilots to do something they shouldn't be doing.
Well, let me ask you something about those quick access recorders. That's something primarily for the airlines to use for themselves. Yet in this accident, apparently the airline is not a party to the investigation. Would they be able to readily read the quick access recorder and understand it, given that there's probably proprietary aspects of that?
Yeah, it is proprietary. But when you pull up to the gate with the airplane, it downloads. You don't have to do anything. It downloads over Wi-Fi. Right?
So with that in mind, John, as we talked on earlier shows, you know, this airplane is a smart airplane. It's pumping telemetry type data, not only for the airplane health, but of course the engine health. That data is going to the airline. It's got to be going to Boeing and General Electric. So the question is, did these guys have early information, telemetry data, well before they got anything off the cockpit voice recorder? And then use the CVR and the FDR to try and validate what they had already pulled down, or at least was pumped down from the airplane prior to the crash.
you know, your guess on what they did with it is as good as anybody's. But the fact is they have the ability to have it. We want to know what they did with it.
We're going to take a short break now to meet one of Avemco's employees from their Frederick, Maryland office.
What's the most challenging calls that you have had?
The most challenging calls that we can get here are senior pilots that aren't qualified, that haven't flown 25 hours or more in the last 12 months, and they don't meet our underwriting guidelines. And so those can be very challenging because you feel for them, but at the same time, you have to abide by our guideline.
And so are they always trying to, you know, finesse you and go, well, but I will, or I did, or, I mean, what do you require for them to prove that they've either flown those 25 hours or will fly those 25 hours for your underwriting?
Well, they tell us, you know, we take their word of mouth, so they tell us we're going to trust them, we're going to believe them, you know, they're going to have current flight review and valid medicals, you know, at least 25 hours, and then there's some that don't have it, they go get it, they call back.
What about the funniest phone call you've ever had where you just started laughing because the information that you got is like, there's just no way I can do anything for this person?
Well, I had a guy that called in one time, and we have basic questions that we ask. Have you had any accidents? Have you had any incidents or claims, DUIs, arrests? And when I asked that question, he said, well, yes, I used my plane to smuggle cocaine back in 1988. And I got real quiet. You could hear a pin drop. And I said, are you serious? And he said, no, I'm just messing with you. It's freaking.
So did you underwrite him?
I think we quoted him, but if we were too high, I can't remember the place. That was a few years ago.
Yeah, well, carried in that caught, kind of cargo, I can imagine the premium was real high.
It caught me off guard. I was like, some people are brutally honest, and some people just like to pull your list. So yeah, at the end of the day, it was fun.
Can they still get insurance if they had a minor landing accident?
Yes, they certainly can. As long as it's outside 36 months, we'll take a look at everything. And
do you require them to demonstrate that they've either had recurrent training after their incident or accident? Is there any criteria? You know, because a lot of times, you know, if the FAA doesn't require a 709 ride, just a, you know, a fresh air check ride, do you all require that before you'll underwrite somebody that had an incident or an accident?
We don't require it, but there's some people that do it, you know, and they'll call back and they're like, hey, I got 20 hours of dual, you know, I'm ready to go, and we'll re-underwrite it, and we'll offer coverage because that is a great thing to say.
Great. How long have you been here, Justin?
About 5 years.
And what's the best part of your job?
The best part of the job is being able to travel, to go to air shows like Oshkosh, Sun and Fun, being able to meet our customers, you know, face-to-face, give them free things. You know, I'm always taking money from them. It's nice to be able to get them something, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's
the other free little good.
Yeah, there's a good tagline. When was the last time your insurance company gave you something other than a bill?
Yeah. So we try to do things. But it's fun to do that.
You got a hat.
You got a hat. It's fun to go to those shows because you get to meet the customers. And when you meet them face-to-face, it's just like you've known them for a long time. And then you establish those connections over years. And they call back and, hey, I remember you.
And now, back to the flight safety detectives.
Maybe they knew in the beginning that this wasn't an accident. Here's another piece that no one's talking about. If this is an intentional act on the part of either one of the pilots to kill the engines for whatever reasons, when, you know, maybe yep. Whatever the reason, I'm not going to get into their mental conditions. But if either one of them took it, it now becomes a crime. It's not covered by Annex 13.
Yes, exactly. And we've seen that with Egypt Air. We saw that with Silk Air. We saw that with German Wings and other events that have been investigated. The PSA accident where an employee shot the flight crew and the airplane crashed in San Luis Obispo, California. These are criminal acts, and that could be the reason why there is no information being released publicly, is because the investigation has taken a turn to being a criminal investigation where you aren't giving public statements about evidence that is being collected.
Well, if it is a deliberate act of some kind, Annex 13 no longer applies, and they could quite legally within the standard practice is not have a report at all. In fact, the U.S., there have been several deliberate acts where there was no formal report, 9/11 being somewhat of an exception to that, but there was nothing out there for things that were deliberate. Some countries, most notably Great Britain with Lockerbie, had a great report. And we did a show not too long ago, I believe, if not here on May Day, air disasters, on the event over in, I think it was Mozambican Airlines, that crashed in Namibia. They had a great report, very detailed report, that kind of report that would not have been done by the NTSB if it were a deliberate act in the States.
Yeah, and the NTSB, I mean, because it's turned over to the FBI, it's investigated as a criminal event. And like with 9/11, the NTSB produced no reports. They assisted the FBI and other investigative agencies as a criminal event, but the board produced nothing as far as, you know, findings and conclusions and that kind of thing. And, you know, that could be the basis for the silence for the last 30 days with regard to this accident. Or I shouldn't even call it an accident, this event, because we don't know if it was an accident, because an accident implies that, you know, it wasn't an intentional act.
Yes, you know, so the silence extends to something as basic as, who was flying the airplane on that particular leg? Now, there were reports that the captain made a mayday call. Does that mean the captain was a pilot not flying, performing duties such as communicating with the outside world? Or was there something else going on where he happened to be the pilot on that leg and he happened to have a need or a desire to communicate on the radio as well? Yeah. I don't know.
And did he take it over even if he wasn't the pilot flying? So when they were coming down the runway, he had to lose power before they rotated because he used so damn much of the runway. So if that were the case, did he take it over if the first officer was flying, the pilot flying? If he was the first officer was the pilot flying, did the captain take it over when he realized he's using too much runway, he was going to have a problem?
And that could explain, John, one, like you said, if the engines were either, well, if the engines were shut down, we'll just leave it at that. If the engines were shut down while the airplane was on the runway, but the captain or the flying pilot determined that they weren't going to get that airplane stopped on the remaining pavement and tried to fly the airplane because going off the end of the runway, they didn't think it was a choice, or they thought that they could, you know, restore power of some sort, that could be the answer for why the airplane initially climbed, the raft dropped. Maybe they were trying to pull the gear up to reduce drag and increase a glide. Who knows? But I mean, there's 1,000 storylines we could put to this scenario, but some of the latest information from a couple of news media outlets is suggested that the focus of this investigation now is with the fuel control switches, which there are two of in the cockpit. They typically reside below the thrust levers. And they're two position switch, John, with a gate or a detent. They're either in cutoff position or they're in the run position. They are mechanical switches, even though they may have an electronic function as far as, you know, producing a signal. They are a mechanical switch that a human must use their hand, pull the switch out of the detent or over the gate to put it in one position or another. They don't magically just move by themselves. And he's worked on them as a mechanic, I'm sure.
Right. No, that's a very common switch for a number of things. In the airplane, where you don't want inadvertent switch activation. That's the whole purpose. You don't want inadvertent switch activation. So this switch, you have to pull it. It has a teardrop shape to it, with the fat end being the portion where you put your hand on it so it doesn't slip. You have to pull it out away from the panel that it's attached to, and then move it, and it will spring load back in to latch it in place. Very reliable switch. Sometimes you said they're on the pedestal. Sometimes they're in the overhead.
Yeah.
And we've had problems with that as well, location-wise. We had an airline in the U.S. where the switches were in the overhead, and one of the pilots reached up thinking it was something else and turned the engines off. No accident, but it was something that was studied immensely because of the event. But in any event, these switches don't move inadvertently. So if it is a switch issue, somebody put their hand on it and moved it.
Yeah. And that's why it's so important. And of course, we in the aviation community are waiting for this preliminary report to see what information there is with regard to this entire event. Is this a operational issue? Is this a mechanical issue? Is it a combination of both? All we can do is wait.
Well, I have one more question for John. It speaks to your experience in government and the NTSB and elsewhere. What does it say to you that the report is going to be released on a Friday? Typically stateside, Friday is a day for bad news to be released by governments, typically right at the end of the business day.
It's common in governments around the world to release something that you don't want to have a lot of questions asked of you, to release it at the close of business for a weekend. So the last day you're going to be working, you release it and you go, you disappear. You're already gone before they release it. And you buy some time not having the answer difficult questions. It's not uncommon for, even here in the U.S. they do that. Government agencies will do that. So out of this report tomorrow, when it gets released, I'm looking for information on the first officer and the captain, more detailed information on both of them. I want to see what they have to say about the switches. Were they activated? My fear in the middle of this, because of the lack of communication, is that they may be struggling, they being the Indian government. Are they looking to blame the manufacturer of the engine, manufacturer of the airplane, in some way? Because it's driven, both the engine and the airplane are driven very heavily with software. Are we going to try to find and blame a software issue because there's really no fingerprints on it? I like to say in my speeches, if you're looking for an electrical leak in a computer-driven airplane, you're not going to find the fluid on the floor. It's hard to find zeros and ones that leak out of components, out of wiring.
Yeah.
Because they don't make the ground. So it's going to be interesting to see if there's any attempt to move the focus of the investigation away from what we know already. Maybe there's a reason to. And if there is a reason, just state the reason. But I'm afraid that the way they've handled information so far, there may be an attempt here to spread the guilt among a number of parties to lower the focus on Air India, their training, their people.
And I noticed, and I'm sure you did too, Todd, that there's been a lot of YouTubers that have been talking about all of the airworthiness directives and service bulletins that have been addressed to this airplane and things like that. One thing about the issuance of ADs and service bulletins for big airplanes, and John, you know this quite well because you had to deal with it, is that, okay, if there is 1 or 100 ADs regarding an airplane, that once that airplane leaves the factory, who's responsible for complying with the airworthiness directives and the service bulletins? It isn't Boeing.
That's right. It's the operator. And most people, they talk about all those issues around the operation, especially outside of the U.S. Boeing, when they sell you an airplane, they give you a package of maintenance material that has to be accomplished and pilot training and pilot operations of the airplane. It used to come in manuals and caseloads of them. There were so many. Today it's all electronic, right? So now you and I just bought an airplane and we live in some island in the Pacific. And we're going to start an airline. And Boeing gives us an airplane with all these manuals. Well, we don't have the money to operate to all of those. So we convince our local authorities we have a better idea. We're only going to do half the training. And the local authorities who have no experience say, okay, that's fine with me. And you go, Boeing has no say in that. Or Airbus, or Embraer, none of them. They don't have any say. The operator can change those manuals at will. It's the aviation authorities in the country they operate in, the one that gives them the operating certificate, that has to control that. And we have seen, you, Greg, you've been over in Indonesia and Malaysia. I've done accidents in Indonesia and Malaysia. And their government authorities are nothing but a rubber stamp.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, maybe they'll mature over time, but at least back in the years that I was over there, they did not have the expertise themselves to really oversee the airline operations. So they accepted whatever the airline wanted to do. And oftentimes what they wanted to do was keep costs to a minimum and lowest training standards.
Well, I think that, you know, all we can do now is just wait and see what comes out. Todd, I think you said you saw maybe something on the internet that this might be a 5-page report of some sort.
That's correct. There was a television network in India, news network, that mentioned very specifically it was a 5-page report. And they were sharing what they said were details in this report. And one of the things I'm looking for is this actually going to be a 5-page report, or will they change things at the last minute and either give us a lot more or a lot less? And that sort of leads into my second to last word. You know, we've been asking a lot of questions here. And at this point, that might be the best route, as opposed to saying, I think I know what happened in this airplane. Ask questions about why they're releasing the information they are releasing, maybe more important, why they're not releasing information you think is a good question to be answered. We're certainly going to be doing that.
Yes. And John, that leaves you with our last word to clean up this particular discussion.
And I'm going to deviate and not do what I've just done in the previous sessions. I'm just going to say to everybody, this 787 has been operating for 15 years, 16 years. I think the number was over 1,000 of them flying. It's proven to be a very, very reliable platform. Accidents do happen. I just don't think this one's an accident. Keep your eyes open, keep your ears open, and watch what they have to say, and also pay attention to what they don't say.
Well put, my friend.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetothetexas@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
Without the right insurance, you're Sierra Oscar Lima. Venco Insurance Company is the only direct writer in the market, never uses third-party agents or brokers. Instead, they connect you directly with real underwriters with real answers in their Frederick, Maryland office, ready to solve problems and approve coverage based on your flying. Floats to wheels and back to floats, Avemco gives you more flexibility. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety today. Don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for 5% off your premium.